suddenly erupted with a screech. Verna reached for her and said, "That child, that child." Lacey handed her over and went to check on the burgers. Chapter 4. When Myers finally made contact, he told Lacey to meet him at the same marina in St. Augustine. Everything was the same. Same sweltering heat and humidity. Same slip at the end of the dock. Myers even wore the same floral print shirt. As they sat at the same wooden table under the shade on his boat, he drank the same brand of beer from a bottle and began talking. His Omar character was in real life a man named Von Dubose, the descendant of one of the original gangsters who did indeed begin their mischief in the rear room of a catfish restaurant near Forest City, Arkansas. His maternal grandfather owned the restaurant, and years later died in a police ambush. His father hanged himself in prison, or at least the official report said they found him hanging. Numerous and various uncles and cousins met similar fates. And the gang had pretty much thinned out until Vaughn discovered the allure of cocaine trafficking in South Florida. A few good years there provided the means to re-solidify his little syndicate. He was now approaching the age of 70, lived somewhere along the coast, and did not maintain a legitimate address, bank account, driver's license, social security number, or passport. Once Vaughn struck gold with the casino, he whittled his gang down to just a handful of cousins, so there would be fewer hands in the till. He operated with complete anonymity and hid behind a wall of offshore companies, all of which were overseen by a certain law firm in Biloxi. By all accounts, and there were not many, he was quite wealthy but lived modestly. "Have you ever met him?" Lacey asked. Myers scoffed at the question.
"Don't be silly. No one meets this guy, okay? He lives in the shadows. Sort of like me, I guess.
You can't find three people in the Pensacola area who'll admit to knowing Von Dubose. I lived there for 40 years and never heard of him until a few years ago. He comes and goes."
"But he has no passport," Hugo said. "Valid passport. If they ever nail him, they'll find half a dozen fake ones."
In 1936, the Bureau of Indian Affairs granted a charter to the Tapakola Nation, a small tribe of about 400 scattered along the panhandle, with most living in small homes in the swampy outback of Brunswick County. The tribe maintained a headquarters of sorts there, on a 300-acre reservation ceded by the federal government 80 years earlier. By 1990, the mighty Seminole Nation of South Florida was discovering the bright lights of the casino trade, as were tribes across the country. Coincidentally, Vaughn and his gang began buying cheap land adjacent to the Tapakola Reservation. At some point in the early 1990s, no one would ever know for sure because the conversations had long since been buried, Dubose approached the Tapakola with a deal too good to be true.
"Treasure key," Hugo mumbled. "You got it. The only casino in North Florida, conveniently located just 10 miles south of Interstate 10 and 10 miles north of the beaches. Full-service casino. Open 24/7, Disney-style amusement, fun for the entire family. Largest water park in the state. Condos for sale, lease, or timeshare. Take your pick. A veritable mecca for those who want to gamble and those who want to play in the sun, and it's perfectly situated within 200 miles of 5 million people. Don't know the numbers because the Indians who run the casinos report to no one, but it's believed Treasure Key is easily in the $500 million a year range."
"We were there last summer," Hugo admitted, as if he'd done something wrong. "One of those last-minute weekend junkets for $1.50. It wasn't bad."
"Bad? It's fabulous. That's why the place is packed and the Tapakola are printing money." And sharing it with Vaughn and his boys? Hugo asked. Among others. But let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Lacey said, That's in Brunswick County, which is in the 24th Judicial District. There are two circuit judges in the 24th, one male, one female. Am I getting warm? Myers smiled and tapped a closed file in the center of the table.
This is the complaint. I'll give it to you later. The judge is the Honorable Claudia McDover. On the bench now for 17 years. We'll talk about her later. For now, please allow me to give you the backstory. It's crucial.
Back to the Tapakola. The tribe was violently split over the issue of casino gambling. The opponents were led by an agitator named San Ruz Ko, who was a Christian and opposed gambling on moral grounds. He organized his followers, and they seemed to be in the majority. The proponents of the casino promised riches for all. New homes, lifetime pensions, better schools, free college tuition, health care. The list went on and on. Von Dubose was secretly funding the drive to approve the casino. But, as usual, his fingerprints could never be found. In 1993, the issue was put to a vote. Excluding those under 18, there were about 300 eligible voters. All but 14 made it to the polls, which were being watched by federal marshals, just in case things turned violent. San Ruz Ko and his traditionalists won with 54% of the vote. A nasty lawsuit alleged voter fraud and intimidation. But the circuit court judge threw it out. The casino was dead. Soon thereafter, so was Sun. They found his body in another man's bedroom, along with the other man's wife, both shot twice in the head. They were naked and appear to have been caught in the act. Her husband, a man named Junior Mace, was arrested and charged with both murders. He had been a close ally of Roscoe's during the gambling debate. Mace steadfastly maintained his innocence, but nonetheless found himself staring at the death penalty. Because of the notoriety, the newly elected Claudia McDover moved the trial to another county, but insisted on maintaining jurisdiction. She presided over the trial and favored the prosecution at every turn. The casino faced two significant obstacles. One was San Ruz Ko. The second obstacle was its location. Much of the Tapakola land was low-lying swamps and bayous and almost uninhabitable. But there was enough high ground to build a large casino with the necessary acreage around it. Getting there was the problem. The road into the reservation was old, was badly maintained, and would never handle the traffic. With the prospect of tax revenue, good-paying jobs, and bright lights, the leaders of Brunswick County agreed to build a new four-lane road from State Route 288 to the reservation's border, which was a stone's throw from the spot where the casino was to be built. But building the road would require the taking of private land by eminent domain, or condemnation, and the majority of the landowners of the proposed right-of-way were opposed to the casino. The county filed 11 lawsuits at the same time, all seeking condemnation of 11 parcels of land along the proposed route. Judge McDover took charge of the litigation, ran roughshod over the lawyers, placed the cases on what amounted to her rocket docket, and within months had the first one teed up for a trial. By then, there was little doubt, at least among the lawyers, that she was squarely in the county's corner and wanted the road built as soon as possible. As the first trial approached, she organized a settlement meeting in her courtroom and required all lawyers to attend. In a marathon session, she hammered out an agreement in which the county would pay each landowner twice the appraised value of his property. Under Florida law, there was little doubt the county could take the land. The issue was compensation. And time. By ramrodding the litigation, Judge McDover saved the casino years of delays. While the eminent domain cases were proceeding as planned, and with Sun Roscoe out of the way, the gambling proponents petitioned for another referendum. They won the second time by 30 votes. Another lawsuit was filed claiming fraud, and Judge McDover dismissed it. The path was now clear to begin construction of Treasure Key, which opened in 2000. Junior Mace's appeals crawled through the system, and though several reviewers were critical of the trial judge and her rulings, no one found serious errors. The conviction survived as the years passed. "We studied that case in law school," Hugo said. "The murder was 16 years ago, so you were what, 20 years old?" Myers asked. "Something like that. I don't remember the murder nor the trial, but it was mentioned in law school. Criminal procedure, I think. Something about the use of jailhouse snitches in capital murder trials." "I don't suppose you've heard of it?" Myers asked Lacey, who replied,
"No, I didn't grow up in Florida."
Myers said,
"I have a thick file on the murder case, complete with the habeas filings. I've kept up with it over the years and know as much as anyone, just in case you need a resource."
"So did Mace catch his wife in bed with Son and take offense?" Lacey asked.
"I doubt it. He claims he was somewhere else, but his alibi witness was shaky. His court-appointed lawyer was a rookie with little experience and no match for the prosecutor, who was a real slick operator. Judge McDover allowed him to call two jailhouse snitches, who said Mace bragged about the killings in jail."
"Should we talk to Mace?" Hugo asked.
"That's where I'd start."
"But why?" Lacey asked.
"Because Junior Mace may know something, and there's a chance he'll talk to you. The Tapacola are a tight, close-mouthed bunch, very suspicious of outsiders, especially those with authority or wearing uniforms. Plus, they are terrified of DuBose and his gang. They have been easily intimidated. And why not keep quiet? They're reaping a windfall. They have homes and cars, schools and health care, money for college. Why rock the boat? If the casino is doing a little dirty business with some gangsters, who cares? Speaking up might get you shot."
"Can we talk about the judge?" Lacey asked.
"Sure. Claudia McDover, age 56, first elected in 1994 and re-elected every 6 years since then. By all accounts, a hard-working judge who's very serious about her job and her courtroom. She wins her re-elections by landslides. Very bright, very driven. Her ex-husband was a big doctor in Pensacola, and he was fond of young nurses. Bad divorce in which she, Claudia, got royally screwed by hubby and his gang of lawyers. Wounded and angry, she went to law school to get revenge. But at some point said to hell with the old boy. She settled in the town of Sterling, the seat of Brunswick County, where she joined a little real estate firm. She struggled and soon got bored with the small-town practice, and at some point, her path crossed with that of Von DuBose. I don't know that part of the story. I've heard a rumor that they might have dated off and on, but again, this has not and probably cannot be verified. In 1993, after the Tapacola had voted against the casino, Claudia McDover suddenly had an interest in politics and ran for circuit court judge. I knew none of this. At that time, I was a busy lawyer in Pensacola and wasn't sure where Sterling was on the map. I had heard of the Tapacola and read about the casino fight, but I had no interest. From all accounts, her campaign was extremely well-funded and well-organized, and she beat the incumbent by 1,000 votes. A month after she took office, Son Roscoe was murdered, and as I've said,
She presided over the trial of Junior Mace. This was 1996, and during this time, Von Dubose and his confederates and limited partners and offshore companies were buying large tracts of land in Brunswick County near the reservation. A few other speculators had jumped in when it looked like the Tapakola wanted a casino. But after the first vote, these guys fled the market. Von was more than happy to take the property off their hands. He knew what was coming, and soon had the Indian land surrounded. With Sunrus Co. out of the way, and removed in such a dramatic fashion, the proponents won the second election. The rest is history.
Lacey pecked on her laptop and soon had a large official photo of Judge Claudia McDover, complete with a black robe and a gavel in hand. She had short dark hair cut in a bob, very stylish, with designer eyeglasses that dominated her face and made it difficult to read her eyes. No smile, not a trace of warmth or humor, all business. Could she really be a party to the wrongful conviction of a man who'd been on death row 15 years? It was hard to believe. "Where's the corruption?" Lacey asked.
"Everywhere. Once the Tapakola started building the casino, Dubose started too. His first development was a golf community called Rabbit Run, which is adjacent to the casino property."
Hugo said,
"We drove by it. I thought it was part of Treasure Key." "No. But from the driving range at the golf course, you can walk to the casino in 5 minutes. Part of the conspiracy with the Tapakola is that they stay away from golf. They handle the gambling and amusement stuff. Dubose gets the golf and everything else. He started with 18 holes at Rabbit Run, all the fairways lined with handsome condos."
Myers slid a file onto the table and said,
"Here's the complaint, sworn to under oath by Greg Myers. In it, I allege that the Honorable Claudia McDover owns at least 4 condos in the Rabbit Run development, courtesy of a faceless corporation called CFFX and domiciled in Belize."
"Dubose?" Lacey asked.
"I'm sure, but I can't prove it. Yet." "What about the property records?"
Hugo asked.
Myers tapped the file. "They're here. They will tell you that CFFX deeded at least 20 units to offshore companies. I have reason to believe Judge McDover has an interest in 4, all showing ownership by foreign entities."
"We are dealing with sophisticated crooks who have excellent lawyers." "What's the value of the condos?" Lacey asked.
"Today, about $1 million each. Rabbit Run has been very successful, even managed to weather the Great Recession. Thanks to the casino, Dubose has plenty of cash, and he likes gated communities with cookie-cutter houses and condos along the fairways. He went from 18 holes to 36 to 54, and has enough land for even more."
"And why did he give the condos to Judge McDover?"
"Maybe because he's just a nice guy. It was part of the original deal, I suppose. Claudia McDover sold her soul to the devil to get elected, and she's been getting paid ever since. The construction of the casino and the development of Brunswick County have created a ton of litigation. Zoning disputes, environmental claims, eminent domain, landowner lawsuits, and she has managed to keep herself smack in the middle of it. Those on the side of Dubose always seem to win. His enemies lose. She's smart as hell and can back up any decision with a thick, well-reasoned legal brief. She is rarely reversed on appeal. In 2001, she and Dubose had a disagreement. Not sure what it was about, but it got ugly. It is believed that she wanted more of the skim from the casino cash. Dubose thought she was being adequately compensated. So Judge McDover closed down the casino."
"How exactly did she pull that off?"
Lacey asked.
Another good story. Once the casino was up and running, and it was printing money from day one, the county realized it would not be getting much in the way of tax revenue. In America, Indians don't pay taxes on casino profits. The Tapakola didn't want to share. The county felt jilted, especially after going to all the trouble of building a spanking new four-lane highway that runs for over 7 miles.
So the county pulled a fast one and convinced the state legislature to allow it to collect tolls on the new road.
Hugo laughed and said, "Right. You gotta stop at a toll booth about a mile from the casino and pay $5 to keep going."
It's actually worked out fine. The Indians are happy now, and the county gets a few bucks.
So when DuBose and Judge McDover had their little spat, she got a lawyer buddy to ask for an injunction on the grounds that the toll booths were crowded and unsafe. There might have been a couple of fender benders, but nothing serious. It was completely bogus crap.
But she immediately issued an injunction closing the toll road.
The casino stayed open because a few folks managed to trickle in from the back roads and such. But it was effectively shut down.
This went on for 6 days, as Vaughn and Claudia waited for the other to blink.
Finally, they got on the same page. The bogus injunction was lifted, and everybody was happy.
It was a pivotal moment in the history of the casino and the corruption it has created. Judge McDover let everybody know that she's in charge.
Hugo said, "You talk about DuBose as if everyone knows him."
"No one knows him. I thought I made that clear.
He runs an organization. A small one in which the big boys are related and everybody is getting plenty of money. He tells a cousin to charter an LLC out of Bermuda and buy some acreage. Another cousin incorporates in Barbados and trades some condos. DuBose is protected by layers of offshore shell companies. He has no profile, leaves no trail."
"Who does his legal work?" Lacey asked.
"A small firm in Biloxi, a couple of tax lawyers who are skilled at dirty work. They've represented the DuBose gang for years."
Lacey said, "It sounds as though Judge McDover is not afraid of DuBose."
"DuBose is too smart to take out a judge, though I'm sure he's thought about it.
He needs her.
She needs him. Think about it.
You're an ambitious and crooked real estate developer in Florida, plus you practically own a casino,
which is illegal, of course,
so you need a lot of protection. What could be more valuable than having a well-respected judge in your back pocket?"
"This has RICO stamped all over it," Hugo said.
"Yes, but we're not going RICO, are we, Mr. Hatch? RICO is federal. Federal is FBI. I don't care what happens to DuBose. I want to bust Judge McDover so my client can collect a small fortune for blowing the whistle."
"How small?"
Lucy asked. Myers finished a beer and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand.
"I don't know. I guess your job is to find out."
Carlita stepped up from the cabin and said,
"Lunch is ready."
Myers stood and said,
"Please join me."
Lacey and Hugo exchanged quick glances. They had been there for 2 hours, were starving and not sure where they would find lunch, but suddenly uncertain as to whether it was a good idea to eat on the boat. Myers, though, was already stepping below.
"Come on, come on," he said,
and they followed him down into the cabin. Three places were set at a glass-topped table in the cramped galley. An air conditioner somewhere was hard at work, and the air was refreshingly cool. The smell of grilled fish hung heavy. Carlita scurried about, obviously delighted to have someone to cook for. She served a platter of fish tacos,
poured sparkling water from a bottle and asked if anyone wanted wine. No one did, and she disappeared deeper into the cabin. Myers did not touch his food, but instead resumed his narrative.
This complaint is not the one I want to file. In this one, I allege corruption only to the extent of the condos owned by Judge McDover in Rabbit Run. The real money in this little conspiracy is her portion of the monthly skim from the casino. That's what I'm really after, because it's a gold mine for my client. If I can nail that down, I'll amend the complaint. If not, there are sufficient allegations to get her removed from the bench and probably indicted.
Do you mention the name of Von Dubose in the complaint? Lacey asked.
No, I refer to his corporations as criminal entities.
That's original, Lacey said.
You got a better idea, Ms. Stultz?
Myers shot back.
Can we drop the Mr. and Mrs. stuff?
Hugo asked.
She's Lacey, you're Greg, I'm Hugo. Fair enough.
All three took a bite, and as he chewed rapidly, Myers kept talking, with his mouth barely closed.
A question. The statute says you have 45 days from today to serve a copy of the complaint on Judge McDover. From now until then, you do your investigation, the, what's it called?
Assessment.
Right. Well, that worries me. I'm convinced these people have no idea that anyone is onto their enterprise, their dealings. And when Judge McDover gets a copy of this complaint, she'll be shocked. Her first phone call will be to Dubose. And at that point, a lot of crazy stuff could start happening. She'll lawyer up immediately, deny everything vehemently, and probably start moving assets around. Dubose will panic, circle the wagons, maybe even start looking for someone to intimidate.
Your question?
Okay. How long can you really wait before you lay this on her? How long can you stall? It seems to me it's crucial to do as much investigating as possible before she knows you're doing it.
Lacey and Hugo studied each other. She shrugged and said, "We're bureaucrats, so we know how to stall. However, if she attacks the way you predict, her lawyers will nitpick everything. If we don't follow the statute to the letter, they'll push hard to dismiss the complaint," Hugo added.
"Let's play it safe and say we'll have 45 days to do our assessment."
"That's not enough time," Myers said.
"That's all we have," Lacey said.
"What can you tell us about your mysterious client?"
Hugo asked.
"How does he know what he knows?"
Myers sipped some water and smiled.
"Once again, you assume the person is a he." "Okay, what do you want to call him or her?" "There are only three links in our little chain. Me, the middleman who referred the client to me, and the client himself or herself. The middleman and I refer to the client as the mole. The mole could be male or female, old or young, black or white or brown. Doesn't really matter right now."
Lacey said, "The mole? That's not very original."
"What difference does it make? You got a more descriptive name?"
"I guess it will have to do. How does the mole know so much?" Myers crammed half a soft taco into his mouth and chewed slowly. The boat rocked in the wake of something larger out there. Finally, he said,
"The mole is very close to Judge McDover, and is trusted implicitly by her honor. Trusted too much, it appears. That's all I can say right now."
After a gap in the conversation, Lacey said, "I have another question. You said these people, meaning Dubose and his gang, are very smart and use good lawyers. Obviously, McDover also needs a good lawyer to clean her share of the dirty money. Who does she hire?"
"Phil
Phyllis Turbin, a trust and estate lawyer in Mobile.
Wow. The girls are getting a black eye in this story, Lacey said.
She and McDover were in law school together, both divorced with no children and very close. So close that they might be more than just friends.
They swallowed hard and digested this. Lacey said, "So, to summarize the case so far, our target, Judge Claudia McDover, takes bribes from thugs, skims casino cash from the Indians, and somehow launders the money with the help of a very close friend who happens to be an estate lawyer."
Myers smiled and said,
"I'd say you're on the right track. I need a beer. Anybody want a beer? Carlita!"
They left him on the pier, waving goodbye and promising to keep in touch. He had dropped hints about disappearing into even deeper cover, now that the complaint was filed and would soon cause trouble. Lacey and Hugo had detected nothing that would indicate how or why Von Dubose and Claudia McDover would suspect Greg Myers, formerly known as Ramsey Mix, and a man they had supposedly never met. It was another gap in his story, of which there were far too many. Chapter 5. They spent the next day in the office, brainstorming with Geismar and putting together a plan. With the complaint on file, the clock was ticking. If things stayed on schedule, Lacey and Hugo would soon drive to the small town of Sterling and serve a copy of it upon the Honorable Claudia McDover. By then, it would be imperative to know as much as possible. First, though, they needed to visit Death Row. Hugo had been there once, on a field trip in law school. Lacey had heard about Stark her entire career, but had never found the excuse to see it. They left early enough to beat the morning rush around Tallahassee, and by the time the traffic thinned on I-10, Hugo was nodding off. The prison was 2.5 hours away. Lacey had not been forced to walk the floors with a crying baby all night. But she had not slept much either. She and Hugo, as well as Geismar, felt as though they were probably sticking their noses into a mess that someone else should clean up. If Greg Myers could be believed, serious criminal activity had been rampant in Brunswick County for a long time. Investigators with far more resources and experience should get the nod on this one. They were lawyers, after all, not cops. They didn't want to carry guns. They were trained to go after corrupt judges, not organized crime syndicates. These thoughts had kept her from sleeping most of the night. When she caught herself yawning, she whipped into a fast-food drive-thru and ordered coffee. "Wake up," she scolded her partner. "We have 1.5 hours to go, and I can't stay awake either."
"Sorry," Hugo said, rubbing his eyes.
They slugged coffee, and as she drove, Hugo summarized one of Sedell's memos.
"According to our colleague, from 2000 through 2009, there were 10 lawsuits in Brunswick County involving a company called Nyland Title, a Bahamian outfit whose registered agent is a lawyer over in Biloxi. In each case, the opposing party tried to compel the identities of the real owners of Nyland Title, and each time the judge, our friend Claudia McDover, said no, off limits. A company domiciled in the Bahamas is governed by its laws, and they have a way of protecting their companies. It's all a shell game, but it's legal. Anyway, Nyland Title must have some great lawyers because it is undefeated, at least in Judge McDover's courtroom. 10-0.
"What kinds of cases?" Lacey asked.
"Zoning, breach of contract, diminution of property value, even an aborted class action by a bunch of condo owners claiming defective workmanship. The county sued Nyland in a dispute over property valuations and taxes."
"Who shows up on behalf of Nyland?"
The same lawyer out of Biloxi. He's the corporate mouthpiece and seems to know what's going on. If Nylan is indeed Von Dubose, then he's well hidden, just like Myers says. Layers of lawyers, as he put it. Nice phrase.
Sounds charming.
Hugo took a sip of coffee and put down the memo. He said,
Look, Lacey, I don't trust Greg Myers.
He doesn't really inspire trust.
But you have to admit that so far, everything he has said is checked out. If he's using us, what's his end game?
I was asking the same question at 3:30 this morning. We have to catch Judge McDover with a pile of cash. Period. If it's recovered, the mole gets his or her share as a reward, and Myers takes a cut. If Von Dubose and his boys get busted, fine. But how does that help Myers?
It doesn't. Unless, of course, McDover goes up in flames with Dubose.
He is using us, Hugo. He's filed a complaint alleging corrupt judicial practices or outright thievery. It's our job to investigate. Anyone who files a complaint against a judge is using us to find the truth. That's the nature of our jobs.
Sure it is. But something is not right with this guy.
I have the same gut feeling. I like Geismar's strategy. We'll poke around a bit, nibble at the edges, develop some history, try to find out who owns those four condos, do our job, but do it cautiously. And if we find real evidence of wrongdoing, we'll go to the FBI. Myers can't stop us from doing that.
Agreed, but he can disappear and never talk to us again. If he has proof of corruption at the casino, we'll never get it if the FBI comes storming in.
What else did Sadell pack for our pleasant drive to Stark? Hugo picked up another memo.
Just some background on Judge McDover. Her elections, campaigns, opponents, stuff like that. Since elections are nonpartisan, we're not sure about her politics. No record of contributions to other candidates and other races. No previous complaints filed with BJC. No complaints filed with the state bar. No felonies or misdemeanors. Since 1998, she has received the highest rating by the State Bar Association. She writes a lot, and there's a long list of papers she's published in legal magazines and such. She also likes to speak at seminars and law schools. She even taught a course in trial practice at FSU 3 years ago. Quite the resume, really. More so than our average circuit court judge. Not much in the way of assets. A home in downtown Sterling assessed at $230,000, built 70 years ago with a mortgage of $110,000. Title issued in her name, McDover, which happens to be her maiden name. She reacquired it right after the divorce and has used it since. Single since 1988. No children, no other marriages. No record of memberships in churches, civic clubs, alumni associations, political parties. Nothing. Law school was at Stetson, where she was a top student. Undergraduate degree from North Florida in Jacksonville. Some stuff about her divorce from her doctor husband, but not worth the time.
Lacey listened intently and sipped more coffee. If Myers is correct, she's skimming cash from an Indian casino. That's rather hard to believe, don't you think? I mean, one of our circuit judges elected by the people and so highly regarded.
It is indeed. We've seen judges do some bizarre things, but nothing as bold as this.
How do you explain it? What's her motive?
You're a single woman with a career. You answer the question.
I can't. What's the other memo? Hugo fished through his briefcase and pulled out some papers.
As they entered rural Bradford County, they began to see signs indicating there were prisons and correctional facilities just ahead. Near the small town of Stark, population 5,000, they turned and followed signs to the Florida State Prison, home to 1,500 inmates, including 400 condemned men. Only California had more men on death row than Florida. Texas was a close third. But since it was more focused on keeping its numbers down, its population was around 330, give or take. California, with little interest in executing people, had 650. Florida longed to be another Texas, but its appellate courts kept getting in the way. Last year, 2010, only one man was lethally injected at Stark. They parked in a crowded lot and hiked to an administration building. As lawyers working for the state, their visit had been facilitated. They were cleared through the checkpoints and escorted by a guard with enough clout to get all doors opened quickly. At Q Wing, Florida's notorious death row, they were cleared past another checkpoint and led to a long room. A sign on the door read, "Attorney Conferences." The guard opened another door to a small enclosed area with a sheet of plexiglass dividing it.
"First trip to death row?" the guard asked.
Lacey said, "Yes."
Hugo said, "I came here once when I was in law school." "That's nice. You got the consent form?" "I do,"
Hugo replied as he put his briefcase on the table and unzipped it. Junior Mace was represented pro bono by a large Washington firm. Before Lacey and Hugo could talk to him, they had to assure the law firm they would not discuss any of the issues pending in his current habeas corpus filing. Hugo pulled out a sheet of paper, and the guard took his time reading it. When it met his approval, he handed it back and said,
"Mace is a strange one, I'll tell you that."
Lacey looked away and didn't want to respond. While she wasn't sleeping the night before, worrying about all the crap that was cluttering her brain, she read a few online articles about Florida's death row. Each prisoner was kept in solitary confinement for 23 hours a day. The other hour was for recreation, a chance to walk around a small grassy area and look at the sun. Each cell was 6 feet by 9, with a 9-foot ceiling. Each bed was smaller than a twin size and just inches away from a stainless steel toilet. There was no air conditioning, no cellmate, almost no human contact, except for the usual chatter from the guards at feeding time. If Junior Mace had not been a strange one before arriving 15 years earlier, he could certainly be excused for being a bit odd now. Total isolation leads to sensory deprivation and all sorts of mental problems. Corrections experts were beginning to realize this, and a movement to reform the practice of solitary confinement was struggling to gain momentum. Said movement had not made it to Florida. A door on the other side opened, and a guard walked through it. He was followed by Junior Mace. Handcuffed and wearing the standard blue prison pants and orange T-shirt reserved for death row inmates. Another guard followed him. They removed the handcuffs and left the room. Junior Mace took 2 steps and sat down at the table on his side. The plexiglass separated them. Hugo and Lacey took their seats, and for a few seconds, things were awkward. He was 52 years old. His hair was long, thick, and gray, swept back into a ponytail. His skin was dark and had not been bleached by the isolation. His eyes were dark, too, large and brown and sad. He was tall and lean with well-formed biceps.
"Probably does a lot of push-ups," Hugo thought.
According to the file, his wife, Eileen, was 32 when she died. They had 3 children, all raised by relatives after Junior was arrested and sent away. Lacey took 1 of 2 phones on her side of the partition and said, "Thanks for meeting with us." He was holding his phone. He shrugged, said nothing. I'm not sure you got our letter, but we work for the State Board on Judicial Conduct, and we're investigating Judge Claudia McDover.
I got it, he said. I'm here. I agreed to the meeting.
He spoke slowly, as if every word had to be considered first. Hugo said,
So, we're not here to talk about your case. We can't help you there, and besides, you have some good lawyers in Washington. I'm still alive. I guess they're doing their job. What do you want from me?
Lacey said, Information. We need the names of people we can talk to. Tapacola, the ones on the good side, your side. That is another world for us, and we can't just show up one day and start asking questions. His eyes narrowed and his mouth turned down, like an inverted smile. He nodded as he glared at them, and finally said,
Look, my wife and son Roscoe were murdered in 1995. I was convicted in 1996 and taken away, shackled in the back of a van. That was before the casino was built, so I'm not sure I can really help you. They had to get me out of the way, me and son, before they could build it. They murdered son, along with my wife, and they got me convicted for it.
Do you know who did it?
Hugo asked. He actually smiled, though the humor did not make it to his eyes. Slowly, he said,
Mr. Hatch, for 16 years I have said over and over that I do not know who killed my wife and son Roscoe. There were some people in the background, some outsiders who eased their way into the picture. Our chief at the time was a good man who got corrupted. These outside folks got to him. I'm not sure how, but I'm sure it involved money, and he became convinced the casino was the answer. Son and I fought back, and we won the first vote in 1993. They thought they were going to win, and they were laying the groundwork to make a lot of money with the casino and the land around it. When our people turned it down the first time, these folks decided to get rid of Sun. And me too, I guess. They figured out a way to do it. Sun's gone. I'm here. The casino has been printing cash for a decade now.
Lacey asked, Ever heard the name of Von Dubose? He paused and seemed to flinch slightly. It was obvious his answer would be yes, so when he said no, they both made a note. That would be an interesting conversation on the ride home.
Remember, he said, I've been gone for a long time. 15 years here in solitary eats away at your soul, your spirit, and your brain. I've lost a lot, and I can't always remember what I should.
But you wouldn't forget Von Dubose if you knew him, Lacey said, pushing.
Junior clenched his jaws and shook his head.
No.
Don't know him, Hugo said. I'm assuming you have a low opinion of Judge McDover. That's an understatement. She presided over a joke of a trial and made sure an innocent man was convicted. She's covering up, too. I've always suspected she knew more than she should have. It was all a nightmare, Mr. Hatch. From the moment they told me my wife was dead along with son, and then the shock of being accused and getting arrested and slammed into jail. By then, the system was clicking right along, and everybody I looked at was a bad guy. From the cops, the prosecutors, the judge, the witnesses, the jurors. I got chewed up by a system that was hitting on all cylinders. In no time flat, I got framed, convicted, sentenced, and here I am.
What's the judge covering up? Lacey asked.
The truth. I suspect she knows I didn't kill San and Eileen.
How many people know the truth? Hugo asked.
Junior placed the phone on the table and rubbed his eyes as if he hadn't slept in days. With his right hand, he raked his fingers through his thick hair, all the way to the ponytail. Slowly, he picked up the phone and said,
"Not many. Most people consider me a killer. They believe the story, and why not? I was convicted in a court of law, and here I am, rotting away and waiting for the needle. I'll get it one day, and they'll haul me back to Brunswick County and bury me somewhere. The story will live on and on. Junior Mace caught his wife with another man and killed them both in an act of rage. That's a pretty good story, right?"
Nothing was said for a moment. Lacey and Hugo scribbled away as they tried to think of their next question. Junior broke the silence with,
"Just so you'll know, this is an attorney visit, so there's no time limit. If you're not in a hurry, believe me, I'm not either. It's about 100 degrees in my cell right now. There's no ventilation, so my little fan just pushes the hot air around. This is a nice break for me, and I welcome you back any time you're in the neighborhood."
"Thanks," Hugo replied.
"Do you get many visitors?"
"Not as many as I would like. My kids stop by occasionally, but those are hard visits. For years I wouldn't allow them to see me here, and they really grew up fast. Now they're married. I'm even a grandfather. But I've never seen my grandkids. Got pictures, though. All over my wall. How would you like that? 4 grandchildren, and I've never been able to touch them."
"Who raised your kids?" Lacey asked.
"My mother helped until she died. My brother, Wilton, and his wife did most of it. And they did the best they could. Just a bad situation. Imagine being a kid and your mother gets murdered. Everybody says your father did it, and they sent him to death row."
"Do your kids think you're guilty?"
"No. They got the truth from Wilton and my mother." "Would Wilton talk to us?" Hugo asked. "I don't know. You can try. I'm not sure he'll want to get involved. You gotta understand that life is pretty good these days for our people. Much better than before. Looking back, I'm not sure Son and I were on the right side when we fought the casino. It's brought jobs, schools, roads, a hospital, a level of prosperity our people had never dreamed of. When a Tapakola turns 18, he or she qualifies for a lifetime pension of $5,000 a month. And that might go up. It's called the dividend. Even me, sitting here on death row, I'm collecting the dividends. I would save it for my kids, but they don't need it. So I send it to my lawyers in Washington. Figure that's the least I could do. When they took my case, there was no dividend system, and they certainly didn't expect any money. Every Tapakola gets free health care, free education, and college expenses if he or she wants it. We have our own bank and make low-interest loans for houses and cars. As I said, life there is pretty good, much better than before. That's the good part. On the downside, there are pretty serious motivational problems, especially among the young. Why go to college and pursue a career when your income is guaranteed for life? Why try and find a job? The casino employs about half of the adults in the tribe, and that's a constant source of friction. Who gets an easy job and who doesn't? There's a lot of infighting and politics involved. But on the whole, the tribe realizes that it has a good thing going. Why rock the boat? Why should anyone worry about me? Why should Wilton help you bring down a crooked judge when everyone might get hurt in the process?
Are you aware of corruption at the casino? Lacey asked.
Mace put the phone down and rummaged through his hair again, as if painfully pondering the question.
His hesitancy suggested he was struggling not with the truth, but with which version of it.
He picked up the phone and said, "Again, the casino opened a few years after I came here. I've never laid eyes on it." Hugo said, "Come on, Mr. Mace. You said yourself it's a tiny tribe, a big casino for a small group of people. It must be impossible to keep secrets. Surely you've heard the rumors."
"Tell me about them."
"Rumors of cash being skimmed and taken out the back door. According to estimates, Treasure Key is now a $500 million casino, and 90% of the gross is in cash. Our source tells us there is a gang of organized criminals in bed with the Indian leaders, and they're skimming like crazy. You've never heard this?"
"I may have heard that rumor, but it doesn't mean I know anything."
"Then who does? Who can we talk to?" Lacey asked.
"You must have a good source, or you wouldn't be here. Go back to your source."
Lacey and Hugo glanced at each other, both with the same image of Greg Myers puttering around the Bahamas on his boat, cold beer in hand, Jimmy Buffett on the stereo.
"Maybe later," Hugo said. "But for now, we need someone on the ground, someone who knows the casino."
Mace was shaking his head.
"Wilton is my only source, and he doesn't say much. I'm not sure how much he knows, but very little of it trickles all the way down here to Stark."
Lacey asked, "Would you call Wilton and say it's okay to talk to us?"
"And what do I gain from that? I don't know you. I don't know if you can be trusted. I'm sure your intentions are good, but you might be walking into a situation where things could get out of control."
"I don't know. I need to think about it."
"Where does Wilton live?"
Hugo asked.
"On the reservation, not far from the casino. He tried to get a job there, but they turned him down. No one in my family works at the casino. They won't hire them. It's very political."
"So there's resentment?"
"Oh, yes. Lots of it. Those who fought the casino are basically blacklisted and can't work there. They still get their checks, but they don't get the jobs."
"And how do they feel about you?" Lacey asked.
"As I said, most of them believe I killed San, their leader. So there is not much sympathy. Those who supported the casino hated me from the beginning. Needless to say, I don't have a lot of fans among my people. And my family pays the price."
Hugo asked,
"If Judge McDover is exposed and the corruption is proven, is there a chance it could help your case?"
Mace stood slowly and stretched as if in pain, then took a few steps to the door, then back to the table. He stretched some more, cracked his knuckles, sat down and picked up the phone.
"I don't see it. My trial was over a long time ago. All of her rulings have been picked apart on appeal, and by some very good lawyers. We think she was wrong on several of them. We think a new trial should have been granted a decade ago and so on, but the appellate courts have all agreed with her. Not unanimously. Indeed, All of the decisions in my case have been split, with very strong dissents in my favor. But the majority rules, and here I am. The two jailhouse snitches who effectively nailed my conviction and sent me away